Thank you for coming on this surprisingly wintry night. As you probably know, this is the second lecture in a series on foreign policy analysis run by the International Relations Department. We had Jeffrey Taliaferro. Later in the term, we're going to have Ted Hoff. But it's my pleasure to welcome today Deborah Welsh-Larsen, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's a particular influence on my own work, and those of you who've suffered all last term and this term in IR411 know she's a particular central academic in that course as well. Deborah, at a lunchtime meeting we had, was regaling us with really interesting discussions of how she was drawn into the cognitive approach to foreign policy analysis while she was a doctoral student at Stanford University, which we might get into. But more importantly, she's written two excellent books, The Anatomy of Mistrust, U.S.-Soviet Relations During the Cold War, and then The Origins of Containment, A Psychological Explanation, a series of edited books and some really fascinating articles in political psychology, one of which you'll have all read and will have discussed during the course. Deborah will talk for about 40, 45, even 50 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions and a discussion. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Deborah Welsh-Larsen. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Professor Dodge for inviting me to your beautiful campus in the exciting heart of London. I've already experienced something that I haven't had much of in today, and that's rain, because I'm from Los Angeles and we're in the middle of a 5-year drought. In fact, I had a whole year with no rain whatsoever. So why did Putin decide to take over Crimea and destabilize Ukraine? Why did Putin intervene in Syria? In classic works on foreign policy, state actions like these are explained in terms of the national interest, which is based on geography and history. But the concept of national interest is vague and subjective. It can be defined differently by different people. The definition of the national interest is a matter of perception. Cognitive approaches to foreign policy compare foreign policy judgments to perception. Like perception, foreign policy judgments are subject to illusions, not because people are irrational, but because of uncertainty and the way that the human mind works. Cognitive approaches to foreign policy make several assumptions. The first is that people have limited mental capacities. They cannot pay attention to everything at once. Rationality is bounded by limits on memory and attention. The second assumption is that beliefs shape the way people interpret the world. For example, some people in the United States have argued that because Iran had a nuclear weapons program, that we cannot trust them to observe an agreement. The current nuclear agreement reached with Iran is flawed because it only lasts for 15 years, after which Iran will be free to pursue its nuclear weapons. Others argue that precisely because Iran wants to build a nuclear weapon, that the nuclear agreement is valuable, because Iran, without the agreement, could build a bomb in 2 to 3 months. And moreover, there will be international inspections to see that Iran does not cheat. So what this shows is that people with different beliefs can reach opposite conclusions from the same information. And the third assumption is that beliefs simplify reality. The world is too complicated and interrelated to understand all at once. The public and foreign policymakers have simplified pictures in their minds, images that they use to make sense of the world. There are several theories that are relevant to foreign policymaking that I'm going to discuss tonight. The first is cognitive dissonance theory. In the 1950s, a social psychologist, Leon Festinger, developed cognitive dissonance theory to explain why beliefs don't change, even when people are confronted with incontrovertible evidence. In his theory of cognitive dissonance, Festinger argued that inconsistencies within a belief system create an uncomfortable state of tension that people are motivated to reduce or eliminate. Cognitive dissonance occurs when two beliefs or opinions contradict each other. Cognitive dissonance is stressful. It creates tension. For example, a person might smoke even though she knows that smoking causes cancer. Every time she lights up a cigarette and thinks about how she could be shortening her life, this creates dissonance and tension. The amount of dissonance depends on the ratio of consistent to inconsistent beliefs. For example, consistent with smoking is the idea that smoking is relaxing and it tastes good. But there are even more cognitions that are inconsistent with smoking. It is expensive, it smells bad, and other people don't like it. You could reduce dissonance by adding consistent beliefs, such as the idea that smoking keeps your weight down. And you could subtract inconsistent beliefs, you know, like the idea that smoking smells bad or it's expensive. In summary, there are four different ways that people can reduce dissonance. First, they can change their behavior. You could quit smoking. Second, you can change the environment. You could invent a cure for cancer. Three, add consistent beliefs, which is what I just talked about. And finally, you could change your beliefs. According to dissonance theory, people are motivated to avoid or distort information that contradicts their beliefs. They engage in selective attention. In other words, people pay more attention to information that supports their beliefs than they do to contradictory evidence. And this can explain why the media has only a limited impact on people's beliefs. People generally only pay attention to information that supports their beliefs. They watch television shows that are consistent with their ideological beliefs, such as in the United States, conservatives watch Fox and liberals watch MSNBC News. And they read newspapers that also support their beliefs. We notice information that supports our beliefs and try to avoid hearing information that does not. When people are nevertheless exposed to contradictory information, they engage in selective interpretation. Their beliefs color reality. For example, people's attitudes toward a presidential candidate influence how they evaluate his performance in televised debates. Supporters of Trump thought that he won the debates. Supporters of Hillary thought the opposite. In another experiment, whether people believed that news coverage of the Middle East was biased or fair depended on their attitudes toward the Middle East conflict. Subjects watched a television program on the Middle East. Subjects that were pro-Arab thought it was biased in favor of Israel. Subjects who were pro-Israeli thought it was biased in favor of the Arabs. And subjects that were neutral thought it was moderate. And yet they all watched the same program. So what impact does the media have on public opinion? Does the media tell people what to think? No, the media tells people what to think about rather than what specifically to think. So all these mechanisms that I've talked about suggest that people don't usually change their beliefs. But one situation in which they do change their beliefs is when they are compelled to behave contrary to their beliefs without adequate justification. That's because when you violate your beliefs, that creates dissonance. You've contradicted what you believe. For example, if someone is asked to give a speech in favor of a political cause in which she does not believe, she will experience dissonance. And one way to reduce that dissonance is to change your beliefs in favor of the speech. How does this affect foreign policy? There are several implications. One is belief system overkill. In advocating foreign policy options, policymakers are unwilling to acknowledge the disadvantages of their preferred policy. In other words, all good things go together. In the Obama administration, those who were in favor of intervening in Syria said that the United States could distinguish between moderate and extremist rebels, that we could provide aid to the moderate rebels without it getting into the hands of the extremists, you know, provide weapons, and that a little bit of aid would help the rebels overthrow Assad. Those who were opposed to intervention argued the opposite. Now, the world is not so conveniently set up that your preferred option has only advantages and no disadvantages. But that's the way people think. Another implication of cognitive dissonance is belief perseverance. In other words, beliefs endure even though the world has changed. If people always interpret evidence so that it supports their beliefs, they will never notice when the world has changed and their beliefs are outdated. And this explains why the Reagan administration thought that the Soviet Union was aggressive and expanding in the 1980s, when we now know that the Soviet Union was on its last legs and the economy was declining. This also explains why the United States distrusted Russia even after communism no longer existed and there wasn't really much of a Russian army. The United States decided to enlarge NATO when Russia was not a threat. And of course, the result is now that Russia is a threat, at least in terms of cybersecurity. Because beliefs persevere, hostile images of the enemy can lead to missed opportunities for cooperation. When the enemy makes a conciliatory gesture, policymakers filter the information through their beliefs that the enemy is untrustworthy and aggressive. They are likely to interpret friendly gestures as a trick or propaganda. When the state making the conciliatory gestures has its motives questioned, it's likely to believe that there's no hope in improving relations. So there's a vicious circle, and conflict is never overcome. And there are plenty of examples of this in foreign policy. After Stalin died in 1953, his successors wanted to reduce tensions with the United States, to make a fresh start with the Eisenhower administration. But Secretary of State John Foster Dulles was suspicious of the Russians. Dulles did not believe that the Soviet Union could ever be sincere about wanting to cooperate with the United States. Dulles concluded that if the Soviets were friendly, it was because they were acting out of weakness, and therefore the United States should push the Soviets even harder, drive them to the wall. The U.S. failure to respond to Soviet overtures strengthened the hardliners in the Soviet Politburo and led to the replacement of Malenkov with Khrushchev, who was much more volatile. The tendency to hold on to one's beliefs is also responsible for many intelligence failures. Intelligence failures include failure to respond to warnings of potential attacks or weapons test. Usually, there's plenty of information available beforehand that the enemy is about to attack, but it's filtered through incorrect beliefs of the opponent. This could explain why the United States overestimated the likelihood that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We knew that Saddam had programs to acquire WMD in 1991. Everyone assumed that Saddam had such weapons. U.S. intelligence officials were attuned to evidence that he had weapons of mass destruction and not to evidence that he did not. Decisions should always be made based on estimation of future cost and benefits. The future. The past is gone. There's nothing we can do about the past. It's water under the bridge. But losses create dissonance. People do not want to admit loss. They are reluctant to accept sunk cost. Therefore, students will continue watching a bad movie because they paid for it. Policymakers will continue fighting losing wars because they do not want to admit that lives were lost in vain. Of course, that means that the longer the war continues, the more lives will be lost in vain. Now, cognitive dissonance theory does not suggest that policymakers are irrational. It would be irrational to change your beliefs every time you got a single piece of contradictory information. No one could function in the world if they had to constantly re-examine their beliefs. But cognitive dissonance theory does view human beings as consistency seekers. On the other hand, people are not always motivated to achieve consistency. Sometimes people do not have strong beliefs on a topic. At other times, they just want to understand reality, what's going on. Attribution theory was developed in the 1970s and is about how people explain and predict the events of everyday life, usually actions by other people. Attribution theory assumes that people want to understand why others behave the way they do. Why? We want to understand other people's behavior so that we can influence them in a desired direction. So you may want to ask someone out for a date, and you want to know why that person was cold to you the last time you saw them, or him or her. Or you may want to influence your boss in a particular way so you can get a raise. In any case, you want to explain and understand that person's behavior. Attribution theory views people as problem solvers or even naive scientists. Just like scientists, people have theories about why other people act as they do. They formulate hypotheses, they look for evidence, and they question their hypotheses. Attribution theory is also relevant to foreign policy making because leaders also try to understand why others behave the way they do. As I mentioned at the beginning, we want to understand why Putin took over Crimea and why he's destabilizing eastern Ukraine. But even though people are scientists, they are naive scientists because they don't always apply the principles of the scientific method to their everyday life. People make mistakes because they take shortcuts. They jump to conclusions before they have enough evidence, or they don't reason scientifically. They simplify. And similarly, foreign policymakers also make errors because they don't always follow the principles of the scientific method, or they take shortcuts. The view that decision makers have biases fits with the image of human beings as cognitive misers. As cognitive misers, people try to minimize mental effort. They try to reduce the costs of thinking. Now, there are several different types of intuitive errors in the way people explain events. One is the fundamental attribution error. In other words, people give too much weight to dispositional causes of behavior and not enough to situational factors. In other words, we fail to see the external pressures that causes someone to behave in a particular way. We assume that the other person's actions are freely chosen and reflect internal characteristics. Dispositional causes refer to stable qualities of a person, such as ability, intelligence, motivation, and personality. So let's say that somebody named Jack is going up to his seat and he trips over the stairs, falls flat on his face. A dispositional explanation would be that Jack tripped because he is clumsy. Situational factors refer to external factors that cause people to behave a certain way. A situational explanation would be that Jack tripped because he injured his foot playing football. The fundamental attribution error suggests that we are too apt to assume that another person's actions reflect his or her personality and fail to look at external pressures that cause them to act a certain way. In one experiment, students were asked to give a speech in support of Castro. Observers inferred that the speech reflected the speaker's true beliefs, even though they knew that the speaker had no choice but to give the speech. In the same way, foreign policymakers tend to infer that the actions of another state reflect its national character, ideology, or domestic political system. They do not take into consideration the pressures that the other state is acting under. When the enemy builds up its weapons, we assume that it has aggressive intentions. But the other state may feel threatened. It may be trying to defend itself. During the Cold War, the United States assumed that the reason why the Soviet Union had this huge army was because it wanted to invade Western Europe. But in fact, the Soviet Union saw itself as encircled by hostile powers, including, you know, foreign bases and aircraft. So the Soviet Union saw its military forces as defensive. A dispositional explanation of Putin's takeover of Crimea would be that he wants to restore the former Soviet Union. A situational explanation would be that Putin reacted emotionally when he believed that the United States was responsible for overthrowing a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine, and that he reacted in an unplanned way. Incidentally, people don't make the fundamental attribution error when explaining their own behavior. Let's say you get on a bus and you ask the bus driver for directions, and he snaps at you and says something unintelligible. Then you say, "What a crabby person." But when you're driving and someone cuts you off and you start screaming, "What a moron," you don't say, "What a crabby person I am." No, you say, "That driver was an idiot who provoked you to react." This reflects the actor-observer difference. We attribute our own actions to the situation and the other's actions to their disposition. It's partly a difference in perspective, as actors were focused on the situation, whereas observers were focused on the person. This means that in international relations, states tend to use a double standard in evaluating their own and others' behavior. They view their own state's actions as defensive and the other state's actions as offensive. The result can be a conflict spiral as each responds to the other. During the Cold War, the United States viewed the Soviet intervention in Czechoslovakia and Afghanistan as aggressive, while viewing the U.S. intervention in the Dominican Republic and Vietnam as defensive. Another bias is the non-event. This means the failure to take into consideration the implications of an event that did not occur. For example, Sherlock Holmes, in one of his cases, said to Watson, "And then there was the curious incident of the dog." And Watson replied, "What curious incident? The dog did nothing." Whereupon Sherlock replied, "The dog did not bark," which should have indicated to Watson that the murderer was someone who was known to the victim. So, in international relations, we fail to consider the dogs that do not bark, the aggression that did not take place, the foreign policy event that did not take place. Two big non-events. The Soviets did nothing to stop Eastern Europe from slipping away in 1989. And the Soviet government did nothing to keep the USSR from falling apart. Never before in history has an empire imploded voluntarily without the pressure of war. While people neglect non-events, they give too much weight to concrete, vivid information, especially obtained firsthand through their own experience. We all remember catchy anecdotes, vivid images, stories, rather than statistical information, which isn't very memorable. An international relations example is that summit meetings are very artificial, contrived situations. Usually everything's scripted out in advance. Everybody knows what they're going to say, and there's an agreement signed. And yet leaders will think that they know the other side based on 30 minutes or an hour at a summit meeting. And they place more credence in their own experience than they do the advice of experts who have studied that country for years. Now remember, one of the assumptions of the cognitive approach is that beliefs simplify reality. Schema theory is based on the idea that people interpret new information in terms of preconceived categories. To simplify reality, we perceive it in terms of patterns. This process is automatic and unconscious. A schema may be defined as a generic concept stored in memory. It may be about objects, events, or people. Schemas include general knowledge about a subject, things that are generally true. Schemas serve important functions in perception and memory. Whenever we are in a new situation, we interpret it in terms of preconceived categories. We size up others in terms of our schemas. If you know that you're going to meet an athlete or a farmer, you have certain expectations of what that person is going to be like. Sometimes we go beyond the information given and see things that weren't there just because they fit the schema. Schemas are also important in memory. Just as you store information in file folders, so we store memories under schemas. The problem is that sometimes people remember things that didn't happen because they fit the schema. And that's why eyewitness testimony can be so unreliable in court. Schemas can be about situations, objects, or people. Schemas about routine situations are called scripts. You know, things that usually happen, situations that usually happen in a particular order. You know, there's the restaurant script, the birthday party script, the fast food restaurant script. Scripts tell people how to behave in different types of situations, such as, you know, when you go to a fast food place, at least in the U.S., you order first, you pay, and then you get your food. Whereas when you go to a restaurant, you sit down and eat and then pay for your food. And how do you know this? Well, it's part of a script. We don't usually notice scripts until you go to a foreign country. And then you don't necessarily know how to behave because you don't know the scripts for that country. For example, we don't have pubs in the U.S. So I had to look up in the guidebook how you order food in pubs. There are also scripts from history. The Munich script holds that if you appease a dictator, then he'll only want more. There's controversy over what the Vietnam script is. Some people say the lessons from Vietnam is never go into a conflict without public support. Others say that the lessons are never go into a war with your hands tied behind your back. The availability bias influences which schema is actually used. The availability bias is the tendency to overestimate the likelihood of events that can be easily remembered or imagined. In other words, that are cognitively available. After reading about a horrific plane crash, the perceived likelihood of being involved in a plane crash goes way up, even though statistically you're more likely to be killed in a car accident than you are in a plane. The availability bias means that foreign policymakers are more likely to seize on historical analogies that they can remember or imagine, which means familiar analogies like Munich or Vietnam or I don't know what analogies you might have in Great Britain, maybe Suez. or Munich. I don't know if that's a popular analogy in Britain. Persona are schemas for people. Persona are stereotypes, like Southern good old boys with the pickup trucks, the mafia wise guy, the New York taxi driver, the Irish cop. Sometimes leaders compare their foreign counterparts to stereotypes from home. Oh, he's just another politician. Oh, he's a machine boss. President Truman viewed Stalin as similar to boss Tom Pendergast, the machine boss who helped him get elected to the U.S. Senate in Missouri. More recently, President Obama compared Putin to a bored kid slouching at the back of a classroom, a comparison that infuriated Putin. Metaphors are schemas about objects that only imperfectly describe the situation. Sometimes people understand the unfamiliar by comparing it to something more close to home. During the Cold War, important metaphors were the domino theory, or the slippery slope, which is, I guess, the opposite of the domino theory. The domino theory was very important. It helped justify U.S. intervention in Vietnam. In the post-Cold War era, we have a new set of metaphors, like drawing a line in the sand, or smoking the terrorist out, or draining the swamp. Schema theory is part of social cognition approach, and it views people as making judgments without much thought. If leaders are guided by schemas, their policies will not necessarily be consistent. They might respond to this and to that, and They'll be all over the place. They're likely to react to the most salient factor in the situation, just like our president-elect. Related to schema theory is the cognitive miser. You know, the scheme. Politicians who use schemas exemplify the cognitive miser in us. Also, part of the cognitive miser approach is self-perception theory. Self-perception theory is about how we come to know our own beliefs. Self-perception theory argues that in many instances, we don't know what we believe. In such instances, we infer our beliefs from our behavior. I eat whole wheat bread every day, therefore I must like it. Or, I voted for Hillary Clinton, therefore I must be a Democrat. And what this means is that change in behavior can lead to change in beliefs, which is contrary to what we usually think of. Once a person takes a new action, like signing a political petition or joining a party, he forms a new image of himself, and he'll be more likely to act on that self-image in the future, behaving consistently. Applied to states, self-perception theory predicts that sometimes states will react in an ad hoc way to events or crises and only later formulate a policy to justify their actions. So the actions lead to the policy rather than vice versa. Self-perception theory might also apply when a decision maker is led into endorsing an action and later adopts beliefs consistent with that action. So one might ask whether that would explain Prime Minister Theresa May's support for Brexit. She seems to be more supportive of it after she was selected Prime Minister than before. Speaking closer to my home, one could argue that Obama became more favorable towards the use of targeted assassinations of potential terrorists using drones as a result of his experience using drones to prevent terrorist attacks. He was sort of drawn into that, you know, by approving drone strikes. And this is surprising when you consider that Obama used to be a professor of constitutional law. So of all the cognitive models that I have discussed, which is the best? Which is most likely to be used? Well, I would argue, consistent with many psychologists, that different theories apply to different individuals. For example, leaders who enjoy thinking and analyzing events may be more subject to cognitive dissonance because they have a greater need for consistency. Officials who do not have much expertise on a topic or who have a low need for cognition may think more schematically. Situational factors may also have an impact on which theory applies. Whether there is adequate time for thinking, the number of competing issues on the table, or the level of stress can affect whether people think rationally. But the point is to use cognitive models of foreign policy to make recommendations to improve the quality of foreign policy. When fallacies and heuristics are explained to people, they usually try to avoid it. They usually try to avoid making such errors. Foreign policymakers also want to avoid fiascos. They want to avoid major disasters like Vietnam or the Bay of Pigs. So we need to help them avoid mistakes. And the way to do that, I would argue, is to develop a better understanding of how people and leaders think about foreign policy issues. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a very clearly argued, well argued, very clearly structured argument. So that gives us a lot to digest and ask questions about. Would anyone like to ask the first question? If you stick your hand. Yes, you, sir.
This goes to one of your last points. You said people want to avoid disasters. Do they? Quite often, people want their view of the world to be confirmed by the disaster happening.
I would argue that politicians are judged by outcomes rather than whether they were correct. And when there are bad outcomes, such as loss of lives unnecessarily, that causes them to lose votes, and they don't want to lose votes. So even though their view might be validated by a disaster, if they're responsible for that disaster, I would think that they would want to try to avoid it, even if they're wrong.
Hi, I have a question also sort of one of the last points that you made about trying to improve the ways in which foreign policy decision makers are making those decisions. And obviously the kind of research that you do is so critical to that. But I guess I want to know sort of what has actually been the uptake of this kind of research outside of academia. Are there any efforts being made to try to increase that uptake as well?
There are advisory panels on the CIA, for example, Robert Jervis, who's written about perception and misperception, consults with the CIA, and you know, after the intelligence failures over Iran in 1979, the hostage taking, and then later the fiasco over Iraq, Jervis was brought in and asked to do a postmortem using psychology.
I suppose I'll jump in and as you move through cognitive dissonance, attribution theory, schema, self-perception, then you concluded by saying it may be down to individual character traits about or individual levels of education about which one of these problems was most prevalent. Now, I suppose that gives rise to two questions. One is the balance between individual personality and society. So if you think, in my reading of your own work on schema, I suspect it's almost impossible to think without the deployment of schema. I think that would be the argument, that we all use schema. And so I suppose what intrigues me is your view on where those schema come from. Are they self-generated through biological processes or inherited through socialization?
They are mostly learned through experience. We all know that dogs have four legs and a tail, usually, and that chairs have four legs. So I think in most cases, they're learned through experience. You know, we accumulate experiences over time and gradually sort of summarize them into schemas. And so people who have different backgrounds would have different schemas. You know, someone who grew up in the inner city would have different schemas from someone who grew up in the suburbs.
Mm. I'm just thinking about the Munich analogy. So if you think, so our own Prime Minister Tony Blair used the Munich analogy to Serbia in the breakup of Yugoslavia, Milosevic centrally, and then used it again along with George Bush to explain Saddam Hussein. George Bush Sr. used the Munich analogy to explain Saddam Hussein again in 1990. What is it about the Munich analogy? Clearly, people who never lived through Munich make it such a kind of reusable, such a powerful deployment. And is that more about us as the recipients, audience, about so they're conning us, as it were, or they're using a powerful emotive history to move us with them, or they actually, what is it within their own use of schema that makes it that so available for them?
It's one analogy that everyone knows, even if you hadn't had much history, that everybody knows about Munich, whereas they might not know about the War of 1812 or the Crimean War. And so when you have to look for an analogy, it's the one that comes to mind. And I think it's powerful because, of course, Hitler is a very horrific individual that everyone remembers and has learned about, whereas you might not, especially if you're an American, you might not know anything about Disraeli or Palmerston or, you know, or even about Jefferson, but you would know about Hitler. I don't think that they're necessarily communists, because these analogies are used in private when, you know, there's nothing to gain from it. We know that George H.W. Bush, you know, the first Bush, happened to be reading a biography of Churchill by Martin Gilbert when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And he was immediately drawn to the Munich analogy, even though, of course, there's a lot of difference between Saddam Hussein and Hitler. Partly, it was a matter of salience. He was just reading about it at the time. And supposedly Margaret Thatcher said to him, "Now don't go wobbly on me, George."
That's good. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Hi. I have a question also related to sort of what matters when. And you said that a lot of it may come down to situational or individual context. And I was wondering where that type of answer, while it rings true, leaves sort of the theorization process, the parsimony, if you want, of analyzing foreign policy context. Because it strikes me that that sort of reductionist, if you want, approach may inhibit us from saying, well, this is a general theme that we see across different individuals and so on, and will by trend then make us basically biographers of decision makers rather than theorists of foreign policy.
Well, one way to avoid that is to use types. And in psychology, they've done experiments and developed a way of categorizing people as having low need or high need for cognition. And this seems to explain a lot of behavior. So in terms of personality types, there may be only, you know, like some people enjoy thinking a lot about abstract events, and other people just do not like to think at all. And these are fairly stable. Also, situational factors can be categorized in terms of, you know, having high distraction. You know, if you distract people by making them count while they're supposed to remember something else, they won't remember that as well. So, you know, they can do experiments in the laboratory and talk about interaction. Now, it's true that it's not as easy to make generalized structural predictions and explanations, but the problem with generalized predictions and explanations is that they only explain broad trends. They don't really explain specific events. So you could say, oh, the balance of power formed, but when and how? You know, that's important. Specific events are important. That's what you can get with foreign policy analysis, is specific events.
Thank you. Also, building on this point that Gustav just mentioned and the types you just identified, are you then suggesting that they are sort of stuck, that they never change? So either you are a person who likes to analyze things, or you are not. In other words, somebody who has not had, let's say, an education that fostered critical thinking will never be able to do so?
Well, this isn't about, yes, they are fairly stable. The research suggests that these tendencies are fairly stable. It's not necessarily critical thinking ability. It's whether or not you enjoy thinking versus acting. And whether you have some people like to think about abstract, you know, issues, you know, like you go to the dorm and you talk to your friends till 3 a.m. about, you know, life and philosophy. And other people would, you know, just rather get about their business, you know, watch a football game or, you know, do something. And these tend to be quite stable, you know, regardless of class. And these tendencies can affect the way people use information. So it's a variable called a need for cognition. And some presidents have low need for cognition.
Can you give us an example?
Well, apart from the most obvious one, you know, Obama is clearly someone who enjoys cognition, thinking about things, and Trump is someone who does not. But even President Truman was somebody who had sort of a low need for cognition. He just did not like analyzing things. You know, he liked to hear something and make a decision, like that.
Right. Who's next? Yes, the lady sitting down on the stump.
Sorry about that. Hello. I wanted to actually go back to your idea about schemas, particularly the scripts that we use. You know, a lot of those ideas, you know, drawing a line in the sand or going way back to the Civil War, waving the bloody shirt as a way to incite the public, what implications are then between using those schemas with the relationship between domestic opinion or educating the people on foreign policy to foreign policy decision-making overall?
The schemas can be very powerful in influencing the public. You know, people respond to these images, and they take on a life of their own. They don't really think analytically. I mean, just think about Donald Trump talking about draining the swamp. Draining the swamp, draining the swamp. That's all people talk about, you know, when he's selecting his cabinet. And what does it mean? Not much, apparently. But it's amazing that when you look at documents... when you look at documents, as I have, you know, memos written by foreign policymakers in the State Department. I once looked at the British Foreign Office stuff for the origins of the Cold War. They use these metaphors in their own deliberations. I mean, there were memos written about the domino theory. And whether or not it was really true, and I think President Kennedy was asked if he believed in the domino theory, and he said, yes, I do. So I think that they also guide foreign policymakers because they're sort of a shorthand. They convey a lot of information just in an abbreviated form. They have emotional resonance, and you can draw applications from them. So I think they're important not only in public opinion, but also in thinking.
But are they unavoidable?
Are they unavoidable? Difficult to say. I think State Department officials think more abstractly. The problem is that if they write too abstractly, they will not influence the leaders. They have to boil their knowledge down into morsels that leaders can understand quickly.
Yes, you said the back.
John Maynard Keynes famously said, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? Now, does this mean that John Maynard Keynes was a man who could cope with a large amount of cognitive dissonance, which I'm conceiving may not all be able to do? Might it not also suggest that we need to aspire to the ability to engage in an ongoing process of reassessing our values in light of facts? In other words, making judgments, a word I notice you've hardly ever used. Now, we can either look for judgments to experts, and there's nobody more expert than John Maynard Keynes, at least he thought himself expert, and indeed one could conceive that he did exercise expertise, and quite effectively, and perhaps laid the basis of the post-war world order, which is now collapsing as we sit here, the liberal international order. So, in other words, this dichotomy between rationality and irrationality is much too stark, it seems to me. I mean, economists tell us we're all rational beings, we know we're not. You then come along and tell us we're not rational beings, and we concede that we're not that either. But we've got to operate somewhere in between. And one point I think you said, that history is in the past, and we mustn't concern ourselves with that. I may be misquoting.
Well, no, past costs are gone.
Yeah, they're gone.
Water under the bridge.
You freely use historical analogies. Now, let's take one of them, just one. When Stalin died, was it not the case there were people who wanted to take Malenkov seriously? Why were those people ignored? Can one explain that in terms of schemas, dispositions, rational perspective, whatever? Or does one have to invoke questions of power, history, even, dare I say it, economic interests? You know, I mean, where are these factors in your thinking? You know, I mean, sorry, it just seems to me that... You know, you've got yourself into a hole and you're digging yourself out of it. But, let's get out of the hole immediately.
Well, I think that would, to go back to your first observation. I think it would be very good if people could be more open-minded and think about their beliefs and be more self-reflective, but it's difficult for a lot of people to do that. Philip Tetlock wrote this book on judgment, you know, whether or not people are able to predict events. And he distinguished two types of people. It seems like I'm always talking about two types. But this comes from Isaiah Berlin, the fox and the hedgehog. And the fox is able to entertain many contradictory ideas simultaneously and, you know, juggle them and respond to contradictory information. And the hedgehog only knows one thing but knows it very well. And so sometimes hedgehogs can win out if the world happens to fit their beliefs. Foxes make more accurate predictions than hedgehogs do overall because the world changes a lot. And so it probably would be better if we could all be foxes. But on the other hand, that's not the way personalities are. You know, you are the way you are. And it's very difficult to change your cognitive style. Hedgehogs can make a lot of contributions just because they have a narrow-minded focus and they keep going and you know they reach their goal. Now, after Stalin died, Eisenhower was generally willing to give the Soviets a chance after they died, but he was not confident in his own beliefs. He deferred. He didn't have any experience in being president and foreign policy, so he deferred to Dulles. And Churchill was also in favor of responding to Malenkov, but there weren't that many people in the United States government who were willing to give the Soviets a chance. And their reluctance, I don't think, can be entirely dismissed in terms of economic interest, because what was the economic interest in prolonging the Cold War? I mean, Eisenhower said, oh, if we could just have disarmament, we could have more to spend on schools and hospitals, and we wouldn't have to spend so much on bombers. So I think even Eisenhower wanted to control the arms race, but couldn't quite bring himself to trust the Soviets.
Yes, James.
Yeah, so it strikes me that some of these comments about generalizability or about the importance of the distribution of power or economic interest, these are in some sense sort of a side of it, right? So there is structure, there's agency, and these are stories, the cognitive stories are stories about agents. And we're suspending for a moment the structure in which the agents exist. So Eisenhower could not wave a magic wand and change the material realities of the world. But we are assuming for a moment that perhaps the difference between Eisenhower and Truman matters, the difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump matters. And then within that, focusing on the agents operating within a structure, focusing on the agents, it's exceptionally useful to have a kind of typology to think about how these actors make sense of the structure in which they're embedded. And knowing about their different kinds of predilections and biases might not be generalizable. But boy, wouldn't you want a really detailed, insightful briefing about the kind of predilections of the man or woman you're about to negotiate with? This person is a person who historically has not fallen victim to the sunk cost fallacy. This is the kind of person who uses these types of analogies. They are big on Munich analogy. They're not big on Munich analogy. Or you're going to Japan. The Munich analogy doesn't make sense. You have to use the Munich analogy. And this is incredibly useful for anybody practicing foreign policy to recognize their own cognitive limits and limitations, but also for those scholars trying to understand variation over time. If we believe agents matter, then how agents make sense of the structure matters.
But cognition may actually be an outcome of structure.
There wouldn't be any agents, right? And there's no agency. The structure is there, but it has to be interpreted.
Right. Right, I agree. The structure has to be perceived in order for it to influence your behavior. If you don't perceive it, then it can't, in my view.
So,
I'm from Pakistan, and I see that, you know, at the starting, we were really good allies with the U.S., and we helped them beat the Soviets in Afghanistan. But now they're having war games with Russia, and then China is pouring in money with the economic corridor, and then Russia wants to join it to the Eurasian corridor. Iran wants it. And given that whatever is happening in the West, and given that Xi Jinping is getting more power in China now after their meeting, do you see a new world order forming and power shifting towards the West, mainly China and Russia?
You mean power shifting against the West?
Against the West and from the West towards maybe China?
I think in terms of aggregate power, it is not shifting towards Russia and China. On the other hand, Russia and China have greater freedom to act now than they used to. And so it depends on whether or not you view power as capabilities or if you refer to it as maneuverability. And in the case of Xi Jinping, he can do just about anything he wants because he's not constrained. He's the chairman of everything. And the same thing with Putin. Putin is able to make a lot out of a weak hand just because, he's free to act and he's very calculating and sort of canny, very shrewd.
So do you see them gaining more allies now that Trump doesn't really care about, say, NATO, or that he wants Japan to pay and Germany to pay and Saudis to pay? So do you see them making them their allies and the U.S. losing on their allies?
No, I think NATO will still exist, and our alliance with Japan, Australia, and South Korea. The United States is like it's like this big boat, and the guy at the top can't really shift the direction of the boat all at once, because there's an enormous bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy is going to fight back. They're already fighting back. And not doing certain things. I mean, the intelligence community is defying Trump, basically.
So this is a basically an institutional argument that says, to some extent, it gets us back to structure and agency, whatever the agency of this man elected president, that the system will constrain him. That's the most optimistic thing I've heard since election. Right, yes, sir.
So my question is about methodology.
And
I'm asking whether attributing particular decisions and actions to psychological mechanisms is essentially an interpretive exercise, and whether political psychology is much more history than psychology, or are there any sort of well-developed scientific criteria by which you judge these types of works?
It's interpretive, but in a more positivist sense than I think the term interpretation is usually used. It's usually used, like in postmodernism, constructivism, to talk about interpretation. But in the case of psychology, you look for observable indicators of particular traits. And you can get those observable indicators from experiments and from theories. And so you look for evidence in the real world. It's useful to have history because there are often documents and you can examine what people wrote, what they said at the time, and their memos. But I think you can also use other indicators even in even when you don't have the historical record. And the idea is to use to find observable indicators of the theory using things that decision makers do not control or cannot easily manipulate. So in terms of language, you could look at the language of Trump and look for certain metaphors or analogies or examples of emotion or styles of reasoning. So it's not necessarily historical, although history is very useful.
Yes, sir.
So history is useful, but it's over. And yet the Munich example seems to live on. But isn't it the case that, of course, these are utterly different circumstances? Is there necessarily an equivalence? And what is the equivalence without an examination? Blair is using it in one way, but what exactly does he mean by it? You'd have to actually take that representation apart to see what he's trying to make equivalent,
You mean examine the analogy in more depth?
Imagine, have a look at that metaphor, see what he's trying to do with it, really. And what is he seeing? What is analogous in that? Yeah.
Right. It's really not a question of what actually happened, because a lot of historical analogies, as you point out, are misleading, simplified, and any historian will tell you that. You know, even Munich isn't really Munich.
No, I mean, going back to your example of the cat, the fox and the badger.
Right, the fox and the hedgehog.
The fox and the hedgehog, yeah. I've heard that as the fox and the cat. And the cat says to the fox, what do you do when you hear the sound of the hunters? And he said, oh, well, I could do this, and I could do that, and I could do the other. And, of course, the sound goes off, you see, and the fox asks the cat, well, what do you do? He said, oh, I run straight up a tree. So, cat does run straight up a tree, but the fox is left dithering about what he's going to do, and, of course, he's eaten up.
Well, the downside to being too analytical is that there's something called analysis paralysis,
yes,
where you cannot act because you consider so many different factors or so many disadvantages. Sometimes a leader just has to act even when there's uncertainty.
Yeah, yeah.
Take a leap of faith. There's always going to be uncertainty.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that when we're analyzing leaders, there are certain indicators that we can use, particularly if there's no historical method. My question is, in situations in which we already have biases, so Vladimir Putin, for example, we have biases about these leaders, often somewhat emotional drivers under those biases. How do we approach accurately perceiving their intentions and their sort of cognitive processes without committing the many errors, the fundamental attribution error, and how do we approach accurately perceiving their intentions?
Well, I think one way is to try to avoid the fundamental attribution error ourselves and try to look to see if there are situational factors that could have caused, say, Putin to behave a certain way. You know, not to jump into conclusions, but think about, well, what does the situation appear like to Putin? And often, you know, you can read about what the Russians are saying, you know, their reason for doing particular things, and it could be propaganda, but could also be what they really think. And then you try to, so you try to avoid the fundamental attribution error, and then you try to develop, as I said, observable indicators and set them out in advance before you analyze. You know, what would I expect to find if Putin were motivated by the desire to reestablish the Soviet Union? What kind of behavior would we expect to see? And then see if you see that. Could we say that Putin is a cold-hearted murderer? You know, what would we see? What kind of behavior would we find? And, you know, sort of act like a, you know, someone trying to diagnose someone else.
Right at the back, sir. Yes, you.
I'm interested in how beliefs. Systems change, so especially as you get older, you have more closed belief systems. From your research, how does, say, the accumulation of dissonant information versus, say, a trauma, which I noticed you didn't mention, but that's something within the cognitive school, how that affects, say, the reopening of the belief system?
The psychological evidence that I've read suggests that belief systems are more likely to change when there's a big shock than they are if information is received gradually. If there's a big shock, a big trauma, a war, an unexpected event, it can lead to a big change in beliefs, whereas if information that is inconsistent arrives gradually, you can dismiss each piece of information gradually over time. But if it comes all at once, then you're more likely to change. And example of this would be, you know, like President George W. Bush was not in favor of foreign policy. He said we would be an humble nation. You know, and then there was he was not in favor of nation building. And then there was 9/11, and that seemed to change all of his beliefs and his entire personality. And all of a sudden, he thought that he had a mission to destroy global terrorism. And I think there are some other examples of, you know, traumas like that or just major shocks. Pearl Harbor, you know, changed isolationist into internationalist.
Right. Anyone else? Again, you
saw my question. This is a theoretical question about you approach your theory from a cognitive perspective. I was wondering if you, what role you think emotion can play in shaping, you know, which schema we choose, or just is there a role for emotion in theories of foreign policy?
And how do you theorize emotion, I suppose, would be the larger question.
Right, there is a role for emotion in even cognitive explanations. For example, I mentioned that people are reluctant to accept sunk cost, and that's because there's an emotion involved in losing. You know, we don't like to lose. Losing is painful. You know, it leads to emotions. Another source of emotion is. is associated with some of these metaphors that I talked about, you know, like Munich, you know, there's an emotional resonance to them, or 9/11 in the United States. 9/11 has a lot of meaning for people, and when that schema is evoked, it also triggers certain emotions, and it makes it more powerful than if it was just something that was written. Personal experience has emotional resonance. Humiliation. That's another thing. Humiliation is very emotional.
What is the 9/11 schema, do you think? So the issue about the Munich analogy, why it's so powerful, is it offers a very simple causal relationship and a kind of undeniable morality, that if we challenged Hitler, less people would have died. Hitler is unambiguously evil, full stop. It strikes me that 9/11, although a huge trauma in American history, and one that will run for a generation, has no clear, or doesn't have a clear actionable outcome.
Well, again, there can be different lessons, but I think the lesson that most people draw from 9/11 is that the United States is no longer invulnerable, that the terrorists are everywhere. The United States cannot stay behind its oceans passively. The United States has to go out and, you know, fight the terrorist. It's not a matter of police action. We have to fight a war against terrorism. And so that's one of the reasons why Trump emphasized ISIS in the campaign. You know, ISIS. I mean, ISIS isn't that really that big of a deal, you know. But it goes back to the 9/11 thing, that we'll never be safe as long as there are terrorists out there. We have to fight wars.
And that serves the military complex as well, wouldn't it? That narrative.
Yes, I guess it does serve the military complex, but it doesn't do that much for California.
You sir first, yes.
Going back to one of the previous questions about the practical implications of a cognitive approach, when you said the main sort of ways that the approach is going to be used by foreign policy practitioners is building something that's a predictive approach, so basically using these insights to predict the actions of other actors, or would they instead be trying to use these insights to actually influence what other foreign policy actors are trying to, how to behave, and, or alternatively, how their electorate sort of interprets issues?
I think they want to use the insights in order to influence other leaders. And, you know, the memos that I've looked at, whenever a president goes to a summit meeting, he usually gets some kind of psychological analysis of his counterpart. You know, how is he likely to behave? You know, Eisenhower got descriptions of Khrushchev. Kissinger wrote descriptions of Brezhnev. So I think, you know, it's both. They want to predict, but they also want to influence the other guy, size him up. I mean, that's one of the reasons for summit meetings. And, well, why do we have summit meetings? They're kind of, like I said, they're artificial. They don't really accomplish anything. It's so that leaders can size each other up.
Yeah, sure. And then you
I have a question
I think, more of a methodological question that relates to the archival work that you did in the textual analysis and the link between beliefs and texts. Specifically, how can we be sure as researchers that the stuff that we find in texts are beliefs rather than, say, rhetorical tools, instruments in a public or political discourse? And then also, how can we make sure that in a text that has 500 words and possibly, potentially a lot of beliefs, we can find the beliefs that matter versus those that don't in a specific decision-making process?
I've written a couple of things about that. I have an article on archive. Well, actually, it's a book chapter on use of archives in this book that's edited by the Ellmans on history and political science. And I have an old article about content analysis, which explains how I used archival documents to infer beliefs. But to go back to your question, how do we know if a decision maker is expressing his true beliefs or is engaged in some sort of persuasion or advocacy? And I would use the formula developed by my dissertation advisor, Alexander George, who said what to whom, under what circumstances. That little schema. Who said what to whom, under what circumstances. So you look at who's the communicator, what did he say, to whom, who is the audience, and with what, under what circumstances. Is he trying to persuade a superior? Is he talking down to someone? Is he in a meeting? So you have to look at the context of each document. You might call this an instrumental model of communication. Now, in terms of how do you know what's important in a document, you know, if is it a paragraph or is it a sentence, you just have to look at a lot of documents, and you know, certain passages will stand out, you know, in terms of the context when you compare them with other things. You can't just look at one document. You sort of have to look at all of the you have to look at as many documents as you can that are in the file and see whether somebody was just thinking aloud. Sometimes policymakers just sort of write for themselves. At other times, they write really influential memos. And you have to sort of know the policy context for a document. Sometimes people take documents out of context. They blow things up, you know, some paragraph that was written somewhere. They really didn't have any influence. So you have to look at the process.
Sure, yes.
Yes, we've been discussing, you know, leaders specifically as individuals. But, you know, decision-making goes through a process of bureaucratic, you know, layers. So my question is, without this, you know, dismissing the cognitive dissonance process, how much can we, you know, apply the schemas to entire administration? Since there, you know, there are very close emulating networks. How can we? Is there a sociology of bureaucratic bodies of specific administration? Since, you know, senior advisors help juniors one and so on. Can we put together sociology and the schemas to study specifically foreign policy?
Well, no one has done that, but that sounds like a really interesting research project. I mean, you could compare different administrations to see if, you know, the bureaucracy changed. I mean, usually bureaucracies have certain code words that they use over and over again, especially things that have acronyms. You know, like the Army. So, you know, you could compare different administrations to see if there's, like you said, a sort of a sociology of different schemas that are predominantly used. I mean, under George Bush, there was the GWAT, Global War on Terror, that was used all the time. And I doubt if they used that under Obama.
Yes. No, not you, sir. You, and then you, and that will be the final one. Right, then the last stream will take it in a round. Yeah. So, yes.
If you take the schema of national resurgence at face value, let's say, for example, national rejuvenation in China, restoration of the Soviet glory, or make America great again, you take it at face value as something that is really happening in the world today. How do you explain it? And why do you think all these countries want to be great again? how is it possible that no country is great and everybody's trying to be great again? Where does this come from?
Right. Well, hold that question, and then there was a question back there.
What's the best way to study foreign policy makers' belief systems, schemas, and psychological tendencies?
Best way to do it, and then final question. Yeah.
Could you explain how the cognitive approach changes in times of crisis?
You mean the cognitive approach explaining crisis events?
Crisis situations and how leaders may have a different way of thinking or a different approach to decision making when under severe stress or time arrest.
Have you got those three questions?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, great.
On greatness, incidentally, when I landed on the plane, I noticed that there were these posters where it said, Great Britain, so, which really struck me. Well, I would say that the reason why all these states want to be great is that it's part of their identity. People want to have a positive group identity. They want to be better than other people. In the case of Russia and China, they have historical identities as great powers, as does Britain, you know. And it's very hard to lose that identity as a great power. Turkey, another great power. So they try to hang on to it. It's a strong motivation, a desire for status, which is a little bit different from cognitive stuff that I've been talking about, but I've also written about it.
But does it derive from the feeling of now it's a multipolar world and there's no longer the opportunity for greatness for any nation, but rather just muddling through different medium powers?
No, I would say the idea of multipolarity is a product of the desire for greatness. In other words, all these countries are saying that the world is multipolar because that makes them feel better. At least Russia and China do, and Russia's been saying that it's multipolar since the 90s.
So what is the best way to study foreign policy belief systems, I think?
I think through case studies. Through case studies of actual consequential foreign policy decisions. You know, I suppose you can also study belief systems quantitatively. Jonathan Renshaw there's several quantitative studies of operational codes and belief systems. So you can also study beliefs over time, study changes in reaction to particular events. But I think the best way to develop an understanding of a leader is actually to study him in a specific case. How does the cognitive approach explain stress-related decision? There's an early body of literature that developed at Stanford in the 1960s called the Stanford Crisis Studies, where they looked at threat, time pressure, and stress, and found that it led to lowered cognitive efficiency and more errors, the desire to place the burden on the other side. And I think that body of literature is still valid, even though crisis decision making hasn't been studied much recently. I think that the original crisis studies are still good. Holste is one of the people who's written about them.
Well, that's great. Well, I think that leaves us to thank our speaker, who's given us a very clear lecture, but also then given us a series of very detailed answers to some very good questions. So thank you very much.